Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How important is the place we call home? And what do we sacrifice by chasing a career that offers a comfortable, even wealthy lifestyle, but requires multiple moves over decades of working? For a large number of well-educated Americans, being upwardly mobile these days requires being physically mobile as well. In order to climb corporate ladders, they understand they will need to relocate every few years. With little control over the cities they work in, these professional relos tend to gravitate toward a particular kind of neighborhood, one that offers great schools, newer, low-maintenance housing, and the familiarity of national chain stores and restaurants close to home. So what are the pros and cons of living this way? Peter T. Kilborn is here to talk about it. He spent 30 years covering economics, social issues, and the workplace for the New York Times. His new book is called Next Stop Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. Peter, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
Start, if you will, by giving us a picture of a typical relo family.
Oh, typically, there'll just be one breadwinner, the male breadwinner. Probably because the family has to lose so much that it's hard for the spouse to continue reestablishing a home with each move. They tend to be typically in their late 30s to late 40s, although they go into about their mid-50s. They tend to be very athletic. Soccer is popular, golf and tennis among the women. They're very active in the schools. The kids tend to do pretty well in the schools. But they have no sense of real attachment to the communities where they live because they know they're going to be leaving them.
So they get involved in the schools basically for the benefit of their children, but they don't necessarily want to join the Rotary Club or the Junior League.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
What do they gain, Peter, by accepting these multiple transfers?
Well, one thing they gain is good wages. Many of these relos, as I call them, come from parts of the country of where there's declining opportunity. The Rust Belt Midwest, the Great Plains, where going home doesn't produce much opportunity. So they're looking for opportunity. They're looking for decent wages, but they're not necessarily money grubbers. They're just looking for a good lifestyle, I suppose. And it's the way to the top of many companies, so that these young people, when they get out of college, go to work for IBM or Merck or Intel, get on a track that can lead them to senior positions in the companies.
How do they keep track of their friends from the last move? Do they tend to stay very close to people?
No. And one one comment that I ran into more than once was I would ask people, how long do you retain some kind of attachment to the last subdivision? And they said about 2 years. That's about as long as they get Christmas cards from people. Hmm. So everything sort of fades away over a two-year period. And over those 2 years, they are reestablishing themselves in a new place. So perhaps they have less energy to pay attention to the old place.
Yeah, you write this really stark thing in the book, and that is the average relo doesn't know where his or her funeral will be and
yeah.
who might show up.
Yeah. And the kids don't know where they were born, but it's more compelling about the funeral business. And I would ask people, hey, you know, where are you going to be buried? They didn't know where your funeral will be. They didn't know who will go. They don't know. Now, some are able to accommodate that kind of situation. They say, throw me in the river. I don't care. But there are many others who have a long sense of generational ties to one place where weddings and funerals are a part of the culture and part of their history. Yeah, and they do a double take when I would ask them those questions. And they didn't have good answers.
Peter T. Kilborn is my guest. His new book is called Next Stop Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. Does there tend to be a point that you observed where the sacrifices that they have made sort of hit these families as opposed to something that they understand from the beginning that they're giving up?
For some, I can't generalize. I mean, they are just, the families are as different as you and I. And so there are some who make all the accommodations, make all the adjustments, and they lead thrilling lives. But there are many others, and I think it's a larger number, who would not describe their lives as thrilling. They do make a lot of adjustments. One of the hardest adjustments is for kids in school, even though they put them in the best schools in suburbs. Still, they're moving from school system to school system. And that can mean changing curriculums, which also can mean setting them back. And, of course, you know about the problems of some teenagers who have difficulty adjusting to new cliques, new schools, and that's a very common problem.
And even within the same family, sometimes a couple of kids will thrive and one will really have a hard time with this way of life.
That's exactly right. And there's one family in there that I guess I won't go into detail about it, but one kid went back to one town where he was born and married into a big family, has lots of kids and staying put. The other one went to the other extreme and he leads backpacking bicycle tours. He doesn't really have a home. So,
yeah, and I wonder when these kids grow up, it certainly doesn't happen in every family in America, but a lot of times there's a tendency to sort of resettle after college back where you grew up. This, I suppose, doesn't happen really with relo families.
No, it doesn't, because, again, as I said, a disproportionate number of them go to college, get into university and whatnot, and there's really nothing to go back to at home that's as challenging as what they see over a wider horizon. Now, doctors and lawyers, I suppose, can go back and be doctors and lawyers in their towns, but that's a very small population. For kids who really want to get out into the wide world and try to make it, they got to get out of town.
So let's talk about parents, because it's not as if relos don't care about the families they have left behind in other cities. In some cases, they will move their elderly relatives to be close by.
Yes, they will, or they will move the elderly relatives, or the elderly relatives will move on their own initiative. Because there the elderly relatives are in Bismarck, North Dakota, and they had three or four kids, and they've all become relos, and they're all way out of town, and the parents never see their kids anymore. So they will pack up and follow at least one of the children and become kind of collateral relos themselves, because as those children are moved yet again, the parents have to move yet again. And that has a sad downside, because there's a point at which the parents become feeble and unable to move, and there they are in a town they've never heard of. There they are in Flower Mound, Texas, and they're from Bismarck, North Dakota, and they don't know a soul. They're in a nursing home or a assisted living facility in Flower Mound and lost.
And I suppose jumping off the relo track also takes most people off this path to corporate success that they've embarked upon.
Yes, it does, and I haven't run into any cases of anyone who regretted having dropped off that corporate track. There are in the book, Chris. There are maybe you saw a couple of families that are profiled who dropped off, and one kind of found religion or found a spiritual interest, and he started an organization that caters to people with needs that he has identified, and he's leading a very gratifying life, and his family is very happy, and they're living more modestly than they did before, but living richly. They don't miss a thing.
And one woman dropped off because ultimately she got divorced.
Yes, there's a case, in the case of that family, there were two divorces, so there were two women who dropped off. And the husband is now carrying on. He's the only he left his job to go to business school, and he's now having trouble finding a job because of the economy. But yeah, you're right.
Can you talk about the kind of housing that appeals to relos?
One of the astonishing things to me in looking at the subject was how similar the housing was from Georgia to Texas to Illinois to Colorado. Now, there would be some superficial differences in terms of the roofing material or the siding or whatever, but the houses tend to be laid out very much alike. They tended to have all the same features: granite counters, stainless steel appliances, Jack and Joe bathrooms on the second floor, that the bathroom that each child can use from their bedroom. what's behind that is the illusion of not moving. When a family is moving from home to home to home, place to place, they can enjoy an illusion of not really moving because the house is essentially the same. And the national brand retail stores and whatnot are right outside the division, the same brands they knew wherever they were before.
Yet they'd rather go to Applebee's and Chili's than try a new place that they either might not like or just feels foreign.
That's right, because the moment they come from Issaquah, Washington, to Alpharetta, Georgia, you know, their first night, all right, let's go out. And they know the menu from Applebee's. There's no reason to go around and experiment. And they're familiar. They feel they haven't moved.
You know, Peter, what's so extraordinary about this book, and you don't profile a single family that seems like bad people, but these are well-educated people, very well-traveled. They've lived all over the country. And yet you get the sense that they're sort of isolated from the broader culture around them in each of these places.
Yes, they are. One family in there speaks at length about that, saying, you know, this is a nice place to live, and we all play tennis and golf, but everybody looks like us. And he doesn't like that. All these people come from places where there was more diversity, whatever kind of diversity, racial, economic, any other kind. But these people move into subdivisions which are price-pointed and defined by the ages that they cater to. So you'll find a subdivision catering to families with children under 12 and with family incomes of $250,000 to $300,000. And that will mean they'll have houses of $400,000 to $500,000. And everything is worked out that way so that there is hardly any variety among the people you meet in the subdivision or among the houses that you see in the subdivision.
And the real estate agents who cater to these folks sort of know exactly what they're dealing with, and it sounds like they move a steady stream of relos into the same neighborhoods and sometimes the same properties.
Yes, they do. They're terrific at what they do. They develop a real expertise in learning how to deal with families that they know are only going to be in a place for 3 years. That's a very different kind of family from someone who's buying a house to live in for the duration of their life or for 30 years.
It's really interesting that they buy these houses instead of renting, but I guess their companies make it sort of comfortable to do that.
Yes. Well, also, renting, you don't end up with any equity in your house. You rent. And this, over the last 15 years, at least until the current crash, has been a way for these people to make bundles of money on reselling their houses.
And they have a guarantee, usually, that they won't, if nothing else, they won't sell for less than they bought the house.
That's right. The company will agree, the employer or an outsource company that the employer works with will agree to buy the house for at least as much as the people paid.
This seems like an expensive proposition for companies.
I didn't hear you, Chris.
This seems like an expensive proposition for companies, but even in this economy, they're still moving people.
Well, it is an expensive proposition for anyone, but then you look at this activity in the context of the company. I mean, you have a multi-billion dollar company like Hewlett Packard, and it has 1,000 people who are living this way. Their houses don't even show up in the balance sheets. It's just too insignificant a figure in the whole picture of Hewlett Packard. But for an individual family, it's a very big figure.
Peter T. Kilbourn is my guest. His new book is called Next Stop Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. After the break, we will talk about the preponderance of these communities in North Texas, and we invite your calls at 1-800-933-5372 and your emails to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former New York Times reporter Peter T. Kilborn. His new book is called Next Stop, Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So you conveniently provide us, Peter, with an index at the back of the book with the top Relovilles in America. And out of the top 25, here's the list from this part of the country: Flower Mound, Frisco, McKinney, Carrollton, Allen, and Plano. What is it about North Texas that makes this sort of Reloville heaven? Or hell, depending on how you want to describe it.
Well, as you recall, maybe 30 to 40 years ago, there began this great migration of industry from the Northeast to the South and Southwest, including Dallas. American Airlines went to Dallas from New York. J.C. Penney went from New York to Plano. As these companies moved to that part of the country, they were able to build huge offices on land that cost them a fraction of what land would have cost in the Northeast and the Northern Midwest. And also their employees would be able to have houses that were infinitely larger than and more desirable than what they had before. So those areas were very appealing on economic grounds, and once the subdivisions and whatnot got established, they became attractive for all kinds of workers for those global companies. I should have said that the companies moving there are largely global. They need an international airport nearby. I think Dallas has two. And interstate highways and all kinds of things that allow the companies to give them access to the economy beyond Dallas.
How does an older Reloville like Plano compare in character with one of the newer ones that is springing up now, like Flower Mound or Frisco?
Well, particularly Frisco, they're not as glitzy because they're older. I mean, you probably are familiar with Richardson, which is really an older one. Carrollton is older. So first of all, the architecture is just simply older, and it looks older. The roads, the infrastructure is older. There's less glitter. And so these places eventually decline. And one reason they decline is that relos stop moving to them. Many employers will discourage a worker from buying a house in an older Reloville because it will be harder to sell. And if the employer is going to be the one selling it, which he often is, he's got to be sure that he's got a house that he can sell. So you get into the older subdivisions of North Dallas, and the sales slow and the decline sort of proliferates, and it's a cycle that doesn't look like it's going to stop.
And by your calculation, it only takes 15% to 20% of a neighborhood or a city of relos to really change the character of things.
Yeah. Well, the reason for that is what economists call a multiplier effect. So you will have a family moving to town, buying a house or renovating or restoring a house, buying their granite counters and their appliances and their window treatments and whatnot, and then they're gone in 2 years or 3 years. So another family is coming in, spending all that same kind of money, doing the same sort of thing. This process of movement through the community, led by the relos, kind of controls the aspect and the look and the character of the local economy. They're spending all the money, and all the money is being spent for them, so that's what you see.
So they might spend money for a Sub-Zero freezer or for granite countertops, but they are not putting a lot of money into civic projects. They have some of the lowest levels of charitable giving among people in their income level.
Yes, and that would seem to be a striking thing when you look at family incomes in many of those suburbs. They're quite high. And yet the charitable contributions are quite low. Well, why is that? It makes some sense to me. If charitable contributions are going for anything in the infrastructure, buildings of any kind, like a museum, the relos aren't going to be there when it opens. Now, that might be selfish and short-sighted and everything else, but they do not see any return for their money. Similarly, they don't participate in a lot of the charitable causes that might not directly affect them. They might run in a race to cure breast cancer, but there'll be a lot of other needs for which there will be fundraising in the community that these people don't really plug into.
So, for example, when a city like Plano wants to put an arts center in, there's not a lot of interest among people who only expect to be there maybe until the time that ground is broken.
Yes, and in my view, people in Plano want a nice, safe place to sleep with without much congestion on the roads. That's where they sleep. That's where they live. They're not there looking for all the features of a major diversified city with all the various amenities that an old city might be able to provide. They don't need those amenities. They need a place to sleep and an easy way to get their kids to school and whatnot, because they're going to be out of there pretty soon, and there's no point in investing in those other things.
I was also surprised, Peter, to read that people don't necessarily, if they're in sort of a suburban area, they're not spending much time coming into Dallas or Atlanta or Chicago to take advantage of what exists within the central city.
Yeah, that's true. And when you think about it, it's hard to say what the average commute time or driving time is from Alpharetta, Georgia to downtown Atlanta, or from the center of Frisco to the downtown Dallas. But I dare say it's going to be 30, 40, 50 minutes or more to get the car, get driving, get the car parked, and go to whatever event you're going to. And these are people who have an awful lot of, have very busy schedules. So they just don't want, they just don't make those trips.
Peter T. Kilbourn is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Next Stop Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Bill in Dallas writes, I believe the generally poor quality of residential construction has plenty to do with the unwillingness of buyers to pay for a level of quality whose long-term payoff they'll never see because they've moved on. So we're left with a secondary market that has substantial problems with quality, not to mention energy efficiency. Did you see that in the quality of the houses that people were buying?
Yeah, I did. And that's a good point that Bill is making. Plano, there are two parts of Plano. There's East and West. And East Plano has a history. I mean, it's been there for a while. There have been relos coming and going for about 40 years. Those houses were built on slabs on top of wet clay. And so you have all kinds of problems arising in the foundations of the houses. And to keep the houses alive, they water them like plants. They put hoses around them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the rest of the construction of the houses is also inferior. And many of those houses now are being renovated, and some are being lost. Interesting thing happening in East Plano is that there seems to be some restoration, some revival of the area when it looked like it was sunken beyond recovery.
We have an email here from Mel in Dallas who writes, this pattern is very familiar to military and government employee families who have to move out to move up. They find themselves rootless, associating only with people they know from work, trading war stories and gripes. It's the price they pay for the tenure they receive. The irony in private sector industry is that they have no tenure, little job or career security, and no friendly colleagues. They are perpetual newcomers. You seem to find people weren't losing a lot of jobs here, but there is that sense that there's no guarantees for these folks.
Oh, that's true. People are not, relos are not losing jobs nearly at the rate that most other people in the economy are. They're too valued by their companies. That said, the whole history or tradition of corporate loyalty to a workforce that exchanged its hard toil and its loyalty for a pension and job security, that's all evaporated. Companies no longer provide that, so the workers no longer provide the loyalty. So they are up and out of there when they see a better opportunity. So it isn't always the negative side. It isn't always losing a job. It's fleeing the job.
And there's also the question of what happens when there's a crisis, a health issue, or someone does have a money problem, and there's not family nearby to call and say, hey, come over and give me a hand.
Yeah.
You have at least a couple of stories in the book where people had problems and they went to call a friend and didn't quite know who they could count on without being
well, that's
a burden.
That's an issue that I think applies primarily to women, and granted, I'm a male, but there seem to be differences in women's needs vis-a-vis friendships from men's, and I think it appeared, or at least from what women would tell me themselves, that they are much more dependent on intimate relationships than men are. And so, when you have some kind of a setback, some kind of a problem requiring a conversation with a confidant, you can't find it if you're a relo. You don't have that kind of attachment, that kind of friendship.
Well, and it would seem that that need is intensified if you're not going off to work every day. If the kids are in school and your husband's off at a job, it's more important than ever to have a strong social life.
Yes, it is. And it, sometimes it gets sort of funny. Maybe I shouldn't laugh, but they do invent kinds of social activities. One is the game of Bunko, which they will freely tell you is a mindless dice game. And every Friday, one Friday evening a month in many subdivisions, wives or spouses, it's wives, will get together and play Bunko, throwing dice. But really it's an opportunity to have a few glasses of wine and complain about their problems, but it's not intimate.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Kelvin calling from Plano. Hey, Kelvin.
Yes, for me, it's kind of ironic is hearing the show is that I go to a lot of corporate meetings, and the questions a lot of times I ask to get to know people is, are there any native Texans? And most of the meetings is always said that they're like an endangered species because everyone in North Texas seem to be from somewhere else, and they're not native to Texas.
Calvin, that's one of the more stunning things I've found when I went to those towns, but also similar towns in Georgia, that nobody speaks Texan and nobody speaks Georgian, except, you know, an old family around or an old merchant. But everybody speaks Anchorman English, and it turns out that they are from all over the country. Some of these communities have more than 70% of the people are from somewhere else.
Are there ways that they have of sort of, you talked about sort of creating these friendships that may not be that intimate. How do they use online technologies and things like that to keep up with people with whom they might have a stronger emotional connection?
Well, they use it all in social relationships, of course, just as much as anybody else is, and these social relationships extend beyond the United States, and you find kids that have connections with any number of nationalities and in any number of places. Chris, are you asking about business, too, or just...
Well, I guess both, yeah.
Yes, well, and the digital connections, the Internet, the Skype, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, all those help families and people communicate, but they are not going to replace relo bills. They aren't going to replace the phenomenon of relocation because these companies are making major deals around the world, and they can't rely on just a Facebook or an email message to confirm a deal. They've got to have people going over there, shaking hands, playing golf with the people, watching the plants get built. They have to have real people around.
How do lifelong relos tend to adjust to their final move?
Well, in the book, there's one family I wrote about. Their name is Selby, and one of the things that made all this fun was how surprising some things were. Well, I went in to see this couple in Littleton, Colorado. He was 71, she's 69. And they have a perfectly nice ranch house. I mean, it's not big fancy. It's just perfectly nice, old, well-kept up place. The living room didn't have much furniture. Now, these are older people. They didn't have a lot of artifacts around. But the coffee table is this big square oak coffee table, and it was covered with books, and they were contemporary books. And I said, gee, you got a lot of books. And they said, we don't own those books. We don't own any books. They don't buy books because books are heavy. And they become accustomed to not having anything that weighs anything because they never know when they're going to move again. And now it's become part of their lifestyle, so they simply don't buy books. They've given away all their silver. They have just a sufficient amount of china for four or five people over for dinner. Nothing extra in the house.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ann in Dallas. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm an adult product of a Relo family, and I think that it has stood me in good stead. We moved every couple of years, and I learned to be adaptable, to make friends easily, to not be afraid of new situations. But having said that, the first thing we did when we moved, number one, we joined a church, instant community. Number two, our whole family approached the situation as if we would never, ever move from that place. So we became involved.
So you almost pretended that you weren't likely to go somewhere in 2 or 3 years.
We knew we would, but there's no sense putting your life on hold. I mean, I think my parents were wise. Why put your life on hold just because you know you're going to move in 2 years?
Well, you were perfectly right. I mean, there are both those approaches that I ran into, families that when they moved, the wives would get everything set up fast and then get involved in as much activity, in community activity as she could. You would see the same thing happening with the parents and the children. But there are those who, as you say, put their lives on hold only because their lives are so short in that one place. Yeah, they can join a church, but they're going to be out of there in maybe 6 or 7 or 8 months. And a church requires a certain amount of commitment if you're a true member. So these people are juggling things, and some juggle them the way you did, and that works. And there are others who simply might like to juggle them but don't have the opportunity.
Peter T. Kilbourne is my guest. We're talking about his book, Next Stop Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter T. Kilbourne. He is a 30-year veteran of the New York Times, having specialized in covering economics, social issues, and the workplace. His new book is called Next Stop Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Chris in the Dallas-Fort Worth area who says, I grew up in a Reloville family, going to 6 different elementary schools and finally settling in Southlake. My brother and I found that a sense of wanderlust is now extremely challenging for us since we're in our mid-20s and in my case are married and can't quite find a way to settle down into a career or lifestyle and has led to world traveling and other adventures. Can you talk a little bit about what happens to Relo kids when they hit the age when they're choosing a career?
Yeah, there are interesting things. Of course, they all don't. I didn't hear the woman's name.
Chris.
Chris. Well, no, I know your name.
I think the emailer is also named Chris.
Okay. At any rate, there are kids who start off in one place and they move and they move and they move, and then they come to recognize that they're different from all the other kids they know in each town they go to, unless they're other Relovilles. There's a term for these kids, and they use it themselves, called third culture kids. They're from everywhere and nowhere. And they have quite a different and very sophisticated worldview, very different from what they see in Frisco High School or one of the Plano high schools. I think that informs them, and I think that fuels their desire to move beyond each of these places where where they settle. They're looking, they've become accustomed to variety. They've been become accustomed to the stimulation of seeing new and different places and hearing new and different languages. So it is infectious with some kids, not all, but it's infectious for those who are willing to be infected.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Fort Worth and speak with Steve. Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Hi, Steve.
Great show. I retired from the Navy about 3 years ago after 30 years, and while it does not necessarily reflect the corporate world and how people have to move in order to gain the next step in their corporate career, in terms of, you mentioned a little bit ago, somebody who didn't have books because it was heavy and had to move. And living lean is something you learn very early on. And how many times you have to, buy and then give away your snow shovel because you move from Chicago to Corpus Christi, Texas, or something like that.
Right.
So it's interesting how, and with respect to children, well, it's a little easier in the military because when they move, they're generally going to a school, and all the military kids have their own, let's say, clique, or at least they can be in their own clique, so if they so choose. There's probably not that for corporate kids.
Right. Well, the big difference, I think, between military and corporate is that in the military, and for the State Department too, you're moving within a government cocoon of government services. Now, it doesn't diminish how difficult moving can be, but very often you're going to similar housing, similar school systems. You have a similar health care system, a similar transportation system to get you to and from, and you always have the PX. Now, these people moving to some town in Saudi Arabia have none of those things, and they have to try to establish an infrastructure around them, whereas within the military, there tends to be a cocoon to sustain people.
We have an email here from Eric in Colleyville who writes, "My wife and I have been married 15 years, during which we have moved 12 times in 7 countries on 3 continents. After our 10th move, we decided to settle down. However, after 1 year, we started to get itchy feet, feeling like there was something wrong with us for not moving on. We started to feel trapped in our surroundings and had to move. I ended up leaving my job just so we could move again." And Eric wants to know if you found this sort of thing in your research.
Well, I'd say he's extreme. Because it's more likely that finally after 10 moves, he said he decided after 10 that they try to stay put. It's much more common for families to talk about winding down, slowing down, so that the kids, for example, can finish high school. But then there is, I've talked about kids who are affected, third culture kids who become infected by the desire to go around. Well, he's a grown-up kid. I mean, the same thing is happening with him. He's got the itchy feet. There's one fellow in my book who says, "I have happy feet," as a way to explain his conflict, his domestic conflicts with his wife, because she doesn't have such happy feet.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Let's go next to Austin and speak with Jan. Hello, Jan.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead, please.
Well, my husband and I, early in our marriage, called ourselves migrant electronics workers because he was an executive in the semiconductor industry. And he decided when our oldest child was about to start school that it was time to stop. And we did. And, you know, I want to say that it's likely we sacrificed some financial gain in that decision. But next week, our 25-year-old and 22-year-old son are gathering with their friends for the 10th year in a row for a week at a lake here near Austin. And, you know, there's just something about creating home. You can buy a house, you can buy granite countertops, you can buy a lot of luxury, but you cannot buy home. And so in contrast to the happy feet and the great experience of traveling and being able to adapt, I'd just like to put in a plug for home. It's really a good experience for everybody.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who would agree with you, and a lot of very, I don't know, psychiatrists and other people who would tell you that there's nothing more valuable to a human life experience and a sense of belonging, a sense of coming from someplace, a sense of home. And that's what these people have relinquished, and that's what, to me, makes them so interesting. They cut those roots that you reestablished.
Is there a difference between people who are sort of moved by their corporations as opposed to people who are in industries where you have to move? I'm thinking specifically of the newspaper business. I know once you start working for the New York Times, you want to hang around, but very often journalists have to go from one small market to another to finally get to that big job.
Well, I did both. I started on small papers and at different locations and ended up at the New York Times, but then was moved a number of times by the New York Times. And so I've done all that, and I loved it because of the nature of the work. As a journalist, you're always out learning things and meeting interesting people, and I think that applies to certain other professions, certain other activities, but maybe not all. I mean, there's some... there are some jobs and careers that are inside. You are a plant manager. You are in charge of semiconductor production at a plant that could be anywhere in the world and might seem just like every other semiconductor plant. So you might not realize the same exhilaration a journalist might.
Did you worry about the effect on your family when you moved early on?
Was I able to what?
Did you worry a lot about the effects on your family when you were moving for your career early on?
No, selfishly, I didn't. My wife has a very resilient kind of nature and a sense of adventure. Mm-hmm. And there were things that she gave up. But our children weren't very old at that point. They were very small. And so I think she probably would say that she had great adventures, but she also missed certain extended family activities that were important to her. But it all worked out.
And you did have a couple of stints away from home where you left the family behind and just went to do your work for a matter of months or whatever it was.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Keller and speak with Jerry. Hey, Jerry.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I missed a little bit of the conversation, but I wanted to make the point that Protestant clergy have been doing this for more than 100 years.
Hmm.
Moving. I've never been more than 10 years in one place and usually more like five.
Is it easier for you, we talked about the church factor, to sort of jump in and feel like there's a great support system around you, or is it just as hard?
Well, you jump in and you find you have a slot, but your family doesn't necessarily have that slot, and they have to find their way.
Yeah, and so do you all have strategies for dealing with a new place?
Well, now that they're all grown and gone, it's a little easier. But basically, we get a library card, go to the movie, try to, maybe buy symphony tickets, things like that to get into the community. But frankly, it's harder than it used to be because you don't have any roots. Your kids are not in school. So you have a harder time making contacts. We live permanently in Waco right now, and while we've been there like 6 years, we still feel like foreigners.
That sound like something you heard from a lot of other people, Peter?
Yes. Well, there are lots of groups I didn't treat. For Protestant clergy is one. Academics, college professors, very often you finish college and get your bachelor's degree, then you go to another university to get your master's and maybe your PhD, and then to yet another to begin your first teaching assignment. And often after that, academics are moved. So they're not entirely unlike the Protestant clergy. And yet there are other groups. There are all kinds of, the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, is one of the biggest relocation operations in the country.
Is that right?
Hears about it, but there they are.
Do you think this trend is changing in this country, or is it sort of locked into what it's been for several decades now?
Well, it's bound to change somewhat, and it's hard to predict how the internet and the global economy will all play out. We don't know what's going to happen with the industrialization of Africa, for example, and it's just hard to predict what kinds of services will be required in other parts of the world. But as the global economy, it's now German companies and Japanese and Korean and American And they're all poaching on one another's turf. They're coming here, and we're going there. And I don't think that's going to stop, and I think it's going to grow. So there'll be more of it, but the actual form it takes is harder to say.
Do these folks tend to always walk into an office or a plant or a business each day, or is there a significant portion of them that can do their work at least a couple days a week from the home?
Well, I think it's probably 8 or 10% do all their work from home, and it might even be higher. In Plano, I think 8% of the people work at home, and not all of them are relos. But among relos, I'd say 8 or 10% or perhaps more, partly because they're working in different time zones. So here they are at Central Time, as you are, but they're working. They've got a customer in the Far East, and they've got staff in Russia, and they're all these people are interacting at various times, and it doesn't make sense to get in a car and go to an office that's open only 8 hours within your own community.
Let's go next. We have time for one final call, I think, from Sigrid in Aubrey. Hi, Sigrid.
Hello. My name is Sigrid, and I'm from Aubrey. And it's really interesting as I'm driving here and I'll pull over and I'm listening to your comments, because I'm one of those people who don't have any roots at all, and I have find it very difficult to find a place where I belong. I was a refugee from Indonesia a long time ago, and a few of my sisters have found roots, but we're all very cultured, and we've lived all over the world, and I've traveled all over the world, and I've kept traveling as I grew, and even my sons have traveled, and now they're very far away from me. And I adopted a little 5-year-old. I'm 56 now. And I've joined a church that has similar kind of people, but I never find a place where I belong.
Well, you know, yeah, that's sad. And yet it's real. It's something that I ran into quite a lot. I think sometimes people find some substitution for it, and it might be sort of along the digital highway, which is to say, maintaining contacts with your son, Sigrid, and with your sisters through these various electronic means might somehow satisfy some of your longing for attachment to a place.
So home is an idea more than a specific physical place.
Yes.
Peter T. Kilbourn is a 30-year veteran of the New York Times. His new book is called Next Stop Reloville, Life Inside America's New Rootless Professional Class. Peter, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I had a good time.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.